or other things, that maybe there were two people here and they came together and then they split up differently or something like that. Okay, so with, if I turned on a video camera and said, what's happening? Okay, I'm doing a bit of surveillance, I'm watching Bob going back and forth. The answer to that question is what's happening kind of depends on scale. Okay, you could say, well, am I going to answer that question by looking at a whole 50 minutes worth of video? In which case you could say Bob's giving a lecture. Or you could say, look at this from the point of view of maybe 1 or 2 minutes worth of video, and you could say, well, he's talking about a particular slide and making a particular point. Or you could talk about it from the perspective of just a few seconds, okay, in which point you could say he's making a gesture, or he's walking over to advance the slide, or he's answering a question, or something like that. Sort of the kinds of interpretation that you would apply to the video data could be very different according to the scale of the video data you're looking at here. So what we're going to look at for now is just at the finest scale, okay, which is sort of short-term action recognition. So we're really just going to look at effectively gestures, okay, and those of you who have looked at the homework assignment will recognize, huh, that's what we're doing in the homework assignment as well too. So there may be, this is not necessarily the technique that I'm recommending you use in the assignment, but this is related to that kind of bit. In fact, this sort of looks at the sort of short-term gesture and actually goes just a little bit further beyond that. Okay, so it kind of does both short-term and sort of a little bit of medium-term right here. Okay, so we're going to look at sort of the action primitives, okay, so like a hand wave, or in this case we're going to look at a tennis swing, or a bit of a gait cycle in a running football player or something like that. Okay, and what defines all of these? They're sort of local kinds of things. We're going to choose a frame in the video, and we're going to look forwards and backwards a bunch of frames, like maybe 5 or 10 frames. That might be, you know, a second forwards and backwards, or half second forwards and backwards, depending on the video rate. Okay, and unfortunately, what we're going to look at is an approach that's called appearance-based. Okay, so in the first part of the lecture series in Advanced Vision, we looked at recognizing a shape using a geometric model. Okay, in that case, it was model-based and it was independent of appearance. The object could be anywhere in the image, but because we had a model, we could sort of recognize it. Whereas here, what we're going to do is appearance-based. So effectively, you know, if you're going to make a model of me walking this way, although this is a walk, and it's pretty similar to me walking this way, those are two very different appearances. I'm moving in different directions, and my orientation is different. So in order to deal with that in this appearance-based approach, I need to have two models, one for me walking this way, one for me walking that way. And that's what we mean by this sort of appearance-based approach. Okay, and another way to think about it is it's sort of viewpoint specific. Again, if my camera was up there, even if I'm walking in one particular direction, if the camera's up there versus the camera over here or the camera over there, they would see different things, and therefore they would learn different models. So you're almost kind of dependent on keeping the camera in the same sort of place. Yeah?
Do we assume that the camera is generally sort of fixed?
Yeah.
Position?
Yeah.
Moving as the person?
Yep, generally. One can extend the problem a little bit to sort of ask the question, how much variation can you tolerate in the camera motion? And people do that kind of thing. They try to learn a little bit of viewpoint invariant recognition of the behaviors, and the way they do it is they have cameras sort of all over all possible orientations. Of course, this becomes very computationally expensive, so part of the trick is to figure out, well, what's the minimum number of different positions, you know, both around the object and the different elevations that you can get away with for sort of recognizing the object. But and they use various techniques to try and increase the range over which it's variant so you can have fewer cameras. Okay, so and we're also going to restrain ourselves a little bit into the range of kind of the image data right here. Okay, so if we're sort of looking ahead to this kind of data. So this is going to be the kind of data we're going to be looking at, sort of typical image here. So here's a video. Here's a little bounding box that we've detected around a moving player. So here's that bounding box enlarged a little bit, so you can see it's blurry with motion blur. There's compression artifacts and all sorts of rubbish in there. And it gives you sort of feeling for the size of the actual object. That's about sort of 30 or 25 or 40 pixels high, something like that. And there's a range at which we could do our visual analysis. And we're going to do in what's sort of a medium field, in which the bodies are sort of like 30 pixels high. Okay. One could also do it sort of at the near field. That's when the camera's kind of zoomed right in on a person. So that would be like a surveillance camera in a shop watching who comes up to the till and try to identify whether it's a hold up or something like that, you know, stick up. Okay. Alternatively, you can also do at the far field where the bodies are pretty small. You can't recognize them. All you can see is that, oh yeah, there's something moving over there. You hardly tell whether it's a person or a dog or something like that. Maybe you want this, you know, around the outside of a prison or something like that, where you just want to see, you don't care. From the automatic detection point of view, you don't care what it is and what it's doing. It just shouldn't be there. So if you detect something, then you flag a human operator who comes in and looks at what's going on. Okay, so those are kind of the two ranges, but here we're going to stuck in the medium field. And the techniques we're going to look at are suitable for the medium field, and it also for your practical assignment, that's kind of in the medium field sort of range as well, too. Okay, well, here's an example of some of the different detections, and we're going to do tracking on it. And here is a case of some of the sort of collected frames or whatever right here. Here's a couple more. This is out of the paper that we're looking at. I don't know why. As I've been detecting this person here and this person here, they stuck somebody else in the middle of the clip. I think they just made a mistake in their paper. But nonetheless, we're going to take sort of a short collection of frames. We've tracked the person along as they're sort of running across the field. And we're going to take sort of the pattern of motion related to what we see right here, and we're going to use that as a way of trying to recognize what the person is doing, whether it's sort of running to the left, running to the right, kicking, goal, that sort of thing. And we're going to do this for tennis as well. Okay, so the first kind of concept that we're going to have to go to is because this person is moving, and because the lighting is changing, and because people wear all sorts of different clothing and things like that, we're not going to work off the actual colors of the pixels, okay, because every person is sort of different. What we're instead are going to do is we're going to work off the optical flow. Okay, so if you remember back to IVR, we looked a little bit at optical flow, and this is where do things move in the image. You can sort of remember maybe a little needle diagram of a car crash against a wall where you can see swirling arrows around the wheels, you can see arrows on the bonnet of the car kind of going upwards as the body of the car is crumpling up and things like that. So the optical flow is a measurement of where are the pixels moving in the image. And the advantage of using that is that it's independent of the color of the actual thing that you're looking at. Well, we're going to have to do one more thing. That's where we're going to have to stabilize that, because we're interested in what the person is doing in terms of his behavior. Okay, so that's like the motion of the arms and legs relative to the body. Or when we looked at the tennis player, we weren't going to be interested in what kind of swing they're doing. But unfortunately, it's coupled. There's a second motion, and that is even though the tennis player is doing a swing, okay, the tennis player is also moving across the image. You know, as they're running, they're also getting ready to do their swing. So that running across the image is not particularly interesting, because that's sort of independent of what the individual action is. So we need to somehow decouple those two things. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to use a thing called sort of stabilizing the optical flow. What you see here is an example of the result of that. What we've done is we've taken the bounding box around the player. This player is actually running across the pitch. And what we've done is we've taken the bounding box around the center of mass of that detected object. And although that bounding box is moving, we sort of ignored all the bounding box movement, and we're only interested in the movement that's inside the bounding box. So we've kind of subtracted all the global motion of the player to effectively stabilize our view on top of that player. So if we looked at a video of it, it would look like the person is sort of running in place rather than running across the pitch. Okay, or same if they're running across the tennis, you remove the running motion and you just have the tennis motion. Okay, so we're going to deal with optical flow because that's illumination invariant. And we're going to stabilize this because we're interested in the local motion rather than the translation of the person across the image. Okay, and then this sort of puts the whole thing together. And so we do our tracking and our stabilizing. That gets our sort of person-centered view of the target. And then once we do that, then we're going to do our optical flow kind of thing to get some sort of description of the local motion. We're going to look at the details of that a little bit more in just a minute. And once we have this description of the motion, we can compare the current description of the motion to whatever descriptions we have in our database. And we can do a kind of classification or recognition algorithm. Okay, it's a bit like recognizing our flat parts in IVR. We had a bunch of stuff in our database, we had a bunch of descriptors, and we found the ones that were the descriptions that were closest to the models, and that became our identity. So that'll give us our retrieved neighbors in the database. That'll be our recognition of our motion, the actual motion right here. And then that'll give us a variety of outputs. So it'll tell us what the action was, and it can tell us where maybe the joint angles in the model. For example, we could link that up with the particular actions and maybe even make a prediction about what the person looked like just from the optical flow. Right.
For this type of system, how do you know how many actions you need to have, or similar actions you need to have in your database? How do you determine?
Okay, so the question is how many actions do you need to have in your database? And I'm not sure if there's a particularly good answer to that question. It's a bit of a try and see sort of question. Certainly you can certainly think about it, you know, sort of look at a football match and you can sort of say, well, what kinds of things did I see the person doing? And you can say, well, I need a model for those certain kinds of things. You can do a kind of learning from data sort of thing where you have all of your descriptors and you do clustering in the appropriate high dimensional space and you find out how many clusters. That will tell you a little bit of how many models you can go through and try and see which things are misclassified, and then you can look to sort of split them apart by adding additional models in. So there's some heuristics for finding it, but I'm not sure if there's really a particularly good way of deciding on that. Okay, so now we're gonna have a little bit more details of some of the steps right there. So I talked a little bit about the image stabilization. They detected the objects by taking the differences of consecutive images for this particular paper to cope with lighting changes. And where there was large changes, then they said, they thresholded and said, okay, there's a target right here. In order to align the images together, I suggested you could sort of start with finding the center of mass of the detected regions and aligning all the center of masses. That gives you a good initial start. They did a little bit something more than that. As once you've got them initially aligned, then they adjusted one image on top of the other, assuming that the person is not going to move a great deal between two frames. You know, at 25 frames a second, people don't move that much. They did a cross-correlation, sort of aligning it, just get slightly better alignment between the different images. Okay, so that just gave you a little bit more on the better stabilization. Okay, so back to our optical flow. So I reminded you a little bit about optical flow previously. Here's another example of that, and then we'll see how they use the optical flow. So here's a little frame from a video sequence. There's a car sort of driving around the corner right here, the white car. There's a dark car right here, and there's another car kind of coming into the field of view right here. And what you've got right here is the sort of the needle map of all the optical flow. So every one of these dots is a sort of a periodically sampled bit of the image, and sort of every, say, like 10 by 10 pixels. And there's a little vector drawn at each of those dots. The direction of the vector shows the direction of the estimated optical flow, and the length of the vector shows the estimated speed of the optical flow, how much it's changing and in which direction. And if you look through the image, you can see like the biggest clumps are all right here. These, actually all these arrows seem to be moving that way, and that sort of makes sense because here's a car sort of moving into the field of view. It's sort of moving horizontally across the image. Okay, here's another one that's sort of pretty similar. This one's going that way into the image, and here's a third one, looks like a taxi or something that's kind of turning around the corner. If you sort of look in here, it looks like a lot of the vectors are sort of moving in this direction, which is sort of what you would expect if the car is moving around the corner that way. There are standard algorithms for estimating the optical flow. We're not going to go into that right here. It's something you can sort of look up. If you use OpenCV, there'll be a, you know, Lucas Canadi or something like that estimate, Michael Black estimate. There's different algorithms for it, but you can estimate the optical flow at every pixel in the image. Okay, and what it gives you is at every point in the image, it gives you a vector, a UV vector, which says what's the direction and the velocity at which this pixel is moving from this frame into the next frame. Okay, so that will be our optical flow, UV. Okay, so if we apply that back to our running football player, so here's a little sort of frame, and we estimate the optical flow using this frame and the next frame, and that gives us the same kind of thing. You see all the little yellow dots right here? Okay, that's the optical flow. Notice that the background, all the little dots are effectively just dots, but that's because the background has been stabilized and it's not moving anywhere. Okay, so the person, you know, there's no optical flow right back there to speak of, a little bit of noise maybe. But whereas the person is moving right here, you can see that there's a lot of optical flow. So where the leg is kind of coming up, you know, sort of pretty high, it's sort of pretty fast optical flow. This elbow back here is sort of swinging pretty fast again, a lot of optical flow. Okay, so it gives a kind of pattern of flow around the person right here. And one could conceivably build your models in terms of this optical flow and recognize that pattern of optical flow and say, okay, well, if I see this pattern, then there's a running person running in this particular direction at this sort of kind of aura, kind of orientation relative to the camera. Unfortunately, this is going to be a little bit too noisy to work with, so we're going to have to adapt. Well, they adapted this technique a little bit, so we'll come up to that in a second. So. Sorry. You're not clear about the
background sensitization part. Say like match the frames, like trying to find points of interest and see like how they should overlap, so they get this or how.
So how do they detect the moving player?
No. How do they do? How do you decide that those points in the background don't actually move? Since
move.
Your player has moved across the field.
That's a good question. Okay, because the camera is moving, there ought to be some maybe optical flow right back here. But at least for the frames that they chose in the example paper, notice there's no lines. It's just grass in the background. So the background is pretty much homogeneous. So this is a homogeneous sort of texture is one place where the optical flow algorithm doesn't work because it depends on comparing how the texture changes horizontally and vertically in the image versus how it changes over time. So since there's no change in the texture, both horizontally, vertically, and over time, it just can't estimate the optical flow. So good question. And I think if there had been a line that this player had run across, then you would see optical flow associated from the line because the camera has moved. Yeah. Although actually, maybe, I'm not sure. It may be that the camera didn't move. Okay, if the camera was stationary and just watching the players, I mean, from the video, of course, people also pan the camera to watch. If the camera didn't move, then the lines would be stationary and there would be no optical flow on the lines either. So, your turn. Yeah.
Wasn't it that the images were aligned, I mean, centered on the players? So
okay, you've caught me out, right? Okay, I made a mistake. You're right. Okay. Although the camera may be stationary,
so
the windows are moving.
The motion flow with respect to the body.
Yeah.
If the upper body part didn't move, for instance,
yeah,
then it would stay stable.
Yeah, so if you look at like the you know, sort of around in here, you don't see that the vectors are very long, right? Okay, so I made a mistake when I said a minute ago about the lines or whatever, but of course, yes, the player is moving, and so the background, relative background is moving, even though the camera may be stationary. So, yeah.
So then is that saying we stabilize, is that one of the reasons why we would stabilize the image so that sequences of images would all be focused on the player, whereas the background would remain more or less uniform, and so those optical flow vectors in the background wouldn't sort of create noise with respect to the player's movement?
Yeah, I think if there was a big line marking going across here, you just see a big blur and you see big optical flow all along the line marking. I'm not quite sure how you would get around that here. I think they just got around it by careful choice of examples, maybe. Okay, two more questions. And okay, yeah.
Can you just use the color information to separate the background from the player?
You could also use the color information in the background to mask out all of that. Yeah, I mean, and certainly you could do that. I mean, you can also, if the camera is stationary, you can also build a background model and say, well, I'm only interested in optical flow in the foreground positions. Okay, so you could subtract that and just sort of mask out anything that's a background pixel. So that would certainly mask out all the optical flow around here. We use that in one of our projects as well. Okay.
Here, it's very susceptible to background formation, setting of the background.
Okay, so the question is, why not compute the optical flow over the whole patch to begin with and then use some information about how the patch moves to correct the optical flow just to leave the player? And the suggestion is this may be a much noisier way of doing it. And you might be right. It would certainly be interesting to try that. Again, as I was mentioning, because this is a research paper, and when the interesting research is when somebody does something new for the first time, which is not always the best technique to do it, but they're the first there, and they've invented something new. I mean, there's loads of people will come along afterwards and say, "Oh, I can do that better," okay, and they probably can, but it was only because that first person went there that opened up the new kind of research area that people got interested in it. Okay, anyway, so we've got this optical flow. It's a bit noisy, and we're not going to work off of that. And what we're going to do is actually two things. Okay, the first is we're going to work with the U component and the V component. Okay, so rather than having the little vectors, we're going to make this into two images. One is the U image and the other is the V image. And so you can see the value, coded values here. So U is, I guess, the horizontal. And so maybe this is, what are the vector directions? So so this one is a kind of mostly leftward sort of movement right in here. So so maybe light values are rightward movement. So maybe light values are going this direction and dark values are going in that direction. And then the V is the vertical component to it. And let's see if I find a good sort of area. So in here, this is all sort of downwards. And that's sort of bright. So maybe bright motion is downwards and dark motion is upwards or something like that. Okay, so this is one thing we're going to do is we're going to split it between the U and V components, and then we're going to do a second split, actually. And that is what they found better. What they're going to want to do is, this is noisy data. You can kind of see, as we've sort of split it up either that way or this way, it's kind of noisy data. And because it's noisy, they're going to want to smooth it. But because when you do the smoothing, it's going to sort of average out the positive and negative components. They're going to cancel each other out and throw away a lot of the patterns that you're interested in. What they're going to do instead is they're going to split up the horizontal motion into its sort of rightward motion and its leftward motion, and similarly the upward and downward motions right here. You're going to make four images out of it rather than two images. So when you do the smoothing, then all the upward motions will sort of average and smooth out the noise a little bit without canceling itself out with the downward motions. Okay, so maybe this is not the best technique to do it, but that's the way they did it. Okay, so and so back here to the theory. So they took the original U and V, sort of horizontal and vertical motions, and they split it up into a four vector at every pixel rather than a two vector, according to sort of the positive or the negative component of that. Okay, and then at that point, they've got this, and then they do their smoothing on it. Okay, so now you can see, so this is with this convolution with a sort of Gaussian smoothing to sort of smear out the individual variations in the noise. So it gives a, looks like a slightly better pattern of the optical flows right here. Okay, so that gives you the optical flow descriptor that you use for one frame, and now they're going to take 50 of these frames stuck together. Okay, that's going to be the instantaneous descriptor of the motion at a particular time. Sort of plus or minus 25 frames, that's like plus or minus 1 second or a, you know, 3/4 of a second. This was done in America, so they use 30 frames a second. In America, in Europe, is 25 frames usually. Okay, so we've got a bunch of these descriptors for each frame, and then we've got a bunch of them put together. And so if we remember back to here, at this point, we now have our motion descriptors. Okay, and now we're going to want to do our retrieving our nearest neighbors. So there's going to be a database of these motion descriptors, and we're going to want to find which ones are most similar to the ones that we've just captured from the image. So we need a distance metric for similarity, and that's what we've got right here. They effectively used a correlation metric. Okay, so our frame right here, it's going to be indexed by x and y. So that's going to be one of these vectors here. So A is going to be our current data. B is going to be what's in our model base. C is going to be, so in x and y are indexing over the horizontal and vertical components of the image. C is indexing over these four different optical flow components, positive, negative of the U and V. Okay, and that's all of the variables except for I and J, and we're going to have a problem of aligning our sequences because our 50-frame block, you don't know whether it's at the start of a run cycle or at the end of a run cycle or something like that. So we're going to have to try out different alignments. That's the I and J. And for each of those different alignments, we sort of multiply them together and sum them up, and that gives our sort of alignment score. Okay, so it's a very simple but somewhat computationally expensive calculation to make. And what you get out of that is going to be something like this. So this is a false color encoding in which the redder the value is, the higher the matching score. Okay, and then these are sort of frames going through a sequence matched with frames going through a sequence. You've got these sort of 50 frame block around each of this, so I, you know, if I picked a particular point right here and took sort of plus or minus 25 frames, then I'm going to do matching with different alignments in the second image, second sequence. Okay, what you can certainly see is that there are some frames that match very well. It's very red, okay, and there's some that match very badly. Okay, that's the blue. Another thing that's really obvious is this kind of diagonal sort of pattern that runs through here. Okay, and that's what you would sort of expect. I've got a so one person is sort of running back and forth like this, and if I get my alignment right, even though it may be a different person, I will also align with another person running back and forth exactly in the same place. Whenever one person's sort of pose is aligned with the other person's kind of pose, you should get a pretty good matched optical flow. That's where you get this pretty high sort of peak right here, right there. And once you get the alignment right, you can expect as you advance through the sequence, both players will advance through the sequence at pretty much the same sort of rate. It's maybe not perfectly, because one person may run a little bit faster than the other, but you should get a pretty good alignment down here. And there's one more thing to notice, and that is that this sort of thing repeats. Sort of, there's five repeating blocks here. Why does it repeat? Yeah, it's a repetitive motion right here. So, you know, if I'm here at this point and I'm here again at this point, this is going to match with that. And that's what you're seeing here exactly, is one sort of gate cycle is matching with different gate cycle instances as we go through here.
Sorry, so just to clarify, would that be like 50 by 50 in this case?
This could be, you know, a couple hundred by a couple hundred. This is the instance of the I and J that we have right back here. So that's the alignment I and J. And then we, that's from a single frame matching. And then we do this over 50 frames, I think, sort of plus or minus when we add it up. Yeah, maybe. It may just be single frame matching. That's what this shows. So I think maybe at this point it's just one frame against one frame. So it's not a little short-term sequence, it's just this bit matched against this bit over here. Well, so each of these things along here is going to be one video frame. So, I don't know. So, when a person's running, how fast does it take to get from one back to the other? Maybe, say, 1 second or something like that? You know, every bit like that is 1 second long. And let's assume we're capturing the video data at 30 frames a second. So, that means sort of from here to there, which is one gate cycle, that's like 30 frames, so that'll be like 30 different indexes along here, maybe. So. All right, I think maybe this is just single frame, because what's coming up next is, here's our time window, our 50 frames. Okay, so our matching score here is going to be a little bit noisy. I mean, in theory, this should sort of match perfectly all the way down the diagonal, but there's some places where it doesn't match very well. And the technique that they use to overcome some of that mess is a kind of smoothing of that particular image. And they did this by a convolution over the 50 frames. So they took a little, at any given point, they took sort of 25 frames before and 25 frames afterwards. Okay, and so here's the 50 frames, so 25 before, 25 afterwards. And they did this sort of in alignment in both directions. So they used a convolution kernel that went in both directions, sort of an averaging kernel. Now, the shape of this kernel is a little unusual. We'll get to that in just a minute. Okay, but it's a little unusual, but they're doing a convolution with this kernel that's sort of 50 by 50 frames. And then this is the data that we had right before. So this is just sort of the standard convolution type thing, and we're doing a bit of a weighted sum to smooth out the noise. But as I said, the convolution kernel is a little bit unusual. And this is the convolution kernel about that. So it has high weights along the main diagonal, which tries to help align the two sequences. But because you're looking at two different people who run at slightly different speeds, what that means is that, you know, the frames may align so far, but if one person runs a little bit faster, they will get ahead in the time sequence a little bit. And so what that allows, what this kernel allows, is mostly it's identical along the main diagonal, but it does have some weight a little bit off the main diagonal, plus or minus one frame, plus or minus two frames. And the further you get away from the current bit, you allow more and more misalignment. Okay, so this is like, you know, 4 or 5 frames difference in the velocity. So when you take this sort of kernel mask here and convolve this image with it. That's what gives you this particular image. Okay, now you can see kind of the clear structure of the tracking the person and their gait cycle much more clearly. You can also see that the two people run at slightly different speeds because they started out aligned here sort of 0, 0 up here, but when you get down here, then it's not in the corner anymore. So this person took this many frames to go through so many gait cycles, whereas this person took only this many frames. Okay, so this person is running a bit faster. Okay, so that's their matching kind of algorithm. So this gives a sort of alignment. They, in the database, you will have a whole set of different gait cycles, and you will do your matching of your one gait cycle against all of the ones in the database. You'll try and find which ones match, effectively which gives you the kind of the brightest stripes going through this, most, you know, kind of highest values and the most well-defined stripe pattern. I'll give you an idea of which is the best match. And then with that, then you can do sort of matching sequences. So here's a case of, I can't remember which is the direct data and which is in the database, but you can sort of see here's two sequences which have been matched together, both in terms of selection from the database and also in terms of alignment. They're not wearing the same clothing, they're not exactly in the same pose, but roughly speaking, you can sort of see that their positions are kind of pretty similar, so that the optical flow and the motion will be about the same. Okay, so this is a sort of a tennis sequence and obviously sort of like a running sequence here as well too. Okay, you can kind of see the, you know, if you look at like the leg positions right here, you can see the leg positions are pretty similar and pretty similar. So it's obviously sort of tracking the alignment of the two different gait cycles pretty well. And the same for the swing cycle. Okay, so those are examples. The way they evaluated this on a more kind of systematic kind of way is they looked at three different collections of motions and they produced what's a confusion matrix. So here with the ballet, they had 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. They had 16 different ballet motions, okay, and then compared them to each other. And you can see most of the time it recognized it correctly. There were a few instances that were incorrectly recognized. I can't recall how many examples. They may have had like 10 instances of each of these different motions from different dancers at different, doing slightly different poses or slightly different rates or something like that. Here's the tennis, they had so six different types of swings, and with the football they had, what, eight different sort of football motions. And in all the cases you can see it's done pretty well with recognizing the particular instantaneous action, sort of the, there's a strong diagonal sort of element to it. It's not perfect, so there's some errors off of the main diagonal, but on the whole it's done pretty well. Okay, so we have seen a technique for doing short-term action recognition. This is the kind of thing that you're going to be doing in the practical assignment. This is a more complicated technique than what you're asked to do. Where in the practical assignment, there's no repetition or anything like that. It's just an individual motion, sort of. It's the kind of the rock, paper, scissors game, okay? And you just see an individual motion in each of the sort of collection of the clips. So you'll be looking at a slightly different technique for recognizing the individual motion, but it's in flavor, it's a bit similar to this kind of thing here. In the case of the practical assignment, we're not going to have to do any stabilization. You've got the window around the object already. You can maybe do a little bit of extra alignment, but it's not really necessary. Okay, it's sort of medium-sized windows are kind of similar. Here we've got a stabilized optical flow to take account of the fact that the person is moving considerably across the image. Okay, we're also using the optical flow to take out all the illumination variations. In the practical assignment, you don't need to worry about that. What we do have here is a way of encoding this temporal structure. Okay, the optical flow components give you some idea what's happening instantaneously, and then the collection of the 50 frames together encodes a little sort of pattern of motion that takes place over sort of 1 to 2 seconds. So it gives a little description of a kind of instantaneous sort of action. And as you saw from the confusion matrices, it worked pretty well. Okay, unfortunately, all these models here that gave us great results were based on a particularly learned point of view. If you move the camera around to from here over to there or to down here, and your database was trained from here, but your live data came from up there, you probably wouldn't do very well. It might still be sort of dominant diagonal, depending on how far you move the camera, but there would be a lot more errors sort of spreading out across the matrix. Okay, so I think that's kind of where we're going to stop right there. I'm not going to go into that. I'm just going to say any other questions or... So with all the echoes in here, I can't quite hear very well.
So the convolution kernel that you used, was it just was acted manually, or was there some way to optimize it using training data?
Right. So the question is, with that little smoothing kernel, I presume you mean this little guy right here. Okay. So the question was, did they do it by hand, or did they optimize it? Well, I don't know is the answer to the question. The paper might say.
Did they explain what kernel they use?
The mathematical form of it?
Yeah.
I can't remember. This may be defined by a little functional form consisting of a couple of Gaussians or something like that. I don't know. In which case they could maybe have learned the Gaussian parameters. Honestly, I don't know whether they learned it or made it up by hand. My suspicion is that they made it up by hand. They maybe tried a couple of them to sort of tweak it a little bit to get better performance. So some of you could kind of do by saying, well, if I look down here, I can look at, you know, sort of how far do people move, and therefore how big does this kind of, you know, how far do people drift because of different speeds, and therefore I can sort of tune the width at this point down here, and then I just kind of cut the width down as I get towards that bit right there. I suspect that it's done by hand, because you'll notice that it's sort of nice and symmetric about both the axes right here, and this side is also the same as that side. And if you were learning by data, learning from the examples, I would be surprised if it would be quite as clean as that. Okay, any other questions? Right. Oh, sorry. Just got on. Yeah, I mean, if you just reduce, if you reduce the parameters just to sort of like two parameters, one is the sort of, or maybe three. One is what's the spread this way. Second, how does it change as a function of this, and sort of as a how does it spread out? So maybe two or three parameters. You could maybe optimize those two or three parameters to maximize the, you know, the number of correct classifications. You know, on this matrix, or to optimize the correct number of classifications here. Yeah. Okay, doke. So next week is Innovative Learning Week. I don't know if there's anything innovative associated with this class. Nobody has asked me to do anything other than not have any lectures. In theory, the MSc students don't get an Innovative Learning Week, but the fourth year students do get an Innovative Learning Week. But it wouldn't be fair to either of the students to have lectures for some and not for the other next week. So there's no lectures next week. But we'll have another lecture there'll be a lecture on Thursday, but not next week. Okay, so see you on Thursday.
I just had a little bit of a query about this over here. It seems here that it's, like you said, it's one frame with another frame.
Okay, so it's one of these frames against one of these other frames at two different times. So this is at time, the color here is at time I versus at time J. Okay, so this is matching this pattern at time I to this pattern at time J.
Okay. From another sequence, obviously.
From another sequence, yeah. So if it was from the same sequence, it would still be a little bit noisy because each time you run through your gate cycle, you don't do exactly the same thing every time.
So another sequence is actually the model that we have stored.
Could
right?
be, yeah, for example. Yeah, I don't know where they got the example, but it could be the model that they stored right there. I mean, it's probably not the same person because they're running at two different speeds slightly.
Okay, and it's they basically take all four of these components and compare them separately and then superimpose.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got the so this loop right here is sort of multiplying this by this for two sequences.
Yeah.
Okay, for over this component, and then this bit sort of
sums up over all four
of the components.
I see. Okay, and then you extend it here to a time. Is this an extension now to the time window of 50 frames?
Yeah, so that's, so we take...
Oh, this is taking the kernel now into account.
Yeah, okay, so that does a weighted average of a neighborhood of 50 pixels around, okay, at any one point here corresponds to a point there. You do a weighted average of the 50 pixels around there with this kernel,
okay,
and that gives you that value.
Okay.
So each value here is a weighted sum of a 50 by 50 neighborhood right here, where these are the weights.
Okay, so the kernel defines the weights for each neighborhood.
Yeah.
Okay, and determining the size of the neighborhood, I mean?
Why 50 by 50?
Oh, okay.
I think they do it by testing.
Maybe, I can't remember. Could be,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
By optical flow, do you mean by registration? The UVs, is that the same?
So like in your project, well, the UVs are the same sort of thing here, but so in your case...
I'm doing the velocities as well, that's why, am I doing optical flow as well?
If you're taking consecutive frames, okay, that would be one way of estimating the optical flow. So one of the ways people can estimate the optical flow is just by correlating exactly as you have in your project. You take a point, you take a neighborhood around that point, and you search in the next image to maximize the match of that point, and then that gives you a UV vector.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one of the ways that people calculate optical flow.
So my one is actually doing optical flow, actually, what I'm doing.
Yeah, considering you're doing consecutive frames. Now, optical flow is really a derivative kind of thing, so you actually want to do this sort of instantaneously. But
am I not doing it frame by frame? So isn't that instantaneous? That's
as instantaneous as you
can
get,
yeah.
given that we're digitizing the frames. Yeah.
Can I ask you about the assignment? For instance, about the background substructure.
Yeah.
There are two background pictures provided. Are we supposed to assume those are the background and subtract those, or I don't know why there are two on the one hand.
There's just two samples.
Maybe to get a mean of the two
Yeah, just two different samples.
Okay, so
are you an engineer? it's okay. So engineers learn by playing until they break things. So let's not break anything. Okay. Right. Okay. Sorry. Yeah.
With that definition, you can say any kid is an engineer.
Exactly.
Good. So can we assume that is the background, or would you expect us to extract it as we did for the IVR assignment?
Here you can use that. That's why we gave the sample, because you only
simplify
have.
Simplify and assume. Okay, this would always be the background.
Yeah,
also
right.
For the testing.
Exactly.
Sequences that
we took the test sequences exactly the same time as the training sequence. So
okay.
It's just with the background. I mean, because you only have like maybe anywhere between sort of 10 and 25 frames for the motion, you don't really have quite enough to estimate the background using
this
sort of...
less than 10, I think,
for some of them.
For each of the sequences.
Well, some of them are up to like 20 or 25 or something.
Okay, that should be better.
Yeah. But in any case, that's why we gave the background.
And about the bounding box, are you expecting to get the because it says get the largest that contains all of the other. Is it that for each sequence we must plot the bounding box for the object, and then in the end compute the bounding box that surrounds all of them? Is that the
idea? Yeah, for each little sequence, because you want to do each sequence independently.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So sometimes the hand is going to be a little bit closer to the camera or a little bit further from the camera. And so what you just want is you want the box that completely surrounds the hand, say,
for all
10 frames or something like that.
For all the 10 frames.
Yeah. So if you, so the way to do it is you find the bounding box for each frame and then you just find what's...
So maybe for demonstrating would be for each sequence, for each frame, we plot the bounding box, and then in the end we plot the surrounding one, or maybe something
Like
that.
For example.
Good.
So for each sequence you might have a different bounding box,
but it
should be okay. And because you're going to do moment invariance, okay, they're invariant to translation, invariant to scale, so it shouldn't really make any difference how big the bounding boxes are. But if for convenience in calculating these motion history images, you do want to fix a kind of same size for all the frames when you combine all the frames together.
Right.
Yeah.
I think tackle.
Yeah, because moments will be calculated on the MHI, right?
Yeah.
Was it 12?
So those are grayscale versions of the moments we saw for binary images from IVR.
But I have tutorial at that time.
I think I have enough questions on my side.
You're next.
The engineer.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you can ask.
Can you have a handout? There may be one or two left up there, and if not, you can print it from the module course page. Yep, they're all on the module page.
Could you explain me more about what does the image stabilization actually do?
Okay, so what we're interested in is the pattern of motion. So, you know, okay, so if you imagine a person were running across the pitch, sort of running, versus a person running across the pitch doing, you know, goal. Okay, what they have in common is the person is running.
Yes.
And what they have is different is the pattern of arm and leg motion is different. And what we want to do is we want to categorize the motion of the arms and legs relative to the body.
So we want to concentrate only on the body.
Yeah, we don't want to have to worry about the motion of the body, whether the person's running fast or slow, or which direction they're moving, or anything like that.
Yes.
So that's why we do the stabilization. We effectively figure out where the whole body is moving, where the whole box is moving. And we always do our analysis relative to the box rather than relative to the whole image.
Or it's like from whole image, we extract only that this portion out.
Yeah.
So this is the stabilized image.
Yeah, so here you can see it's stabilized. Even though this person, so you can see here's a line right there. Even though the person is running from here to there, the only bit we
just capture out that
the box, yeah.
Yeah, and what do we mean by threshold temporal difference?
Well, the temporal difference is you subtract two consecutive images. So if you remember back at the beginning of, did we do it? Maybe it was in the end of the last lecture or something. We had the cars, and we took the difference between. The four cars, okay, and we subtracted the two images and then we thresholded the difference. Well, that's the technique that they used for detecting the moving players. They subtracted the two consecutive images.
Oh, so they detect the person by subtracting the image.
Yeah, they subtract it and then they take the absolute value and then they threshold it. And if it's above a certain level,
that means there is a movement.
Yeah, significant, yeah. And they probably did some cleaning on, you know, eroding, you know, individual pixels to get rid of small noise and stuff like that too.
So after they got like that region of movement, they normalize.
Yeah. Okay. So then they've then they found the region where the person is. So here's the whole image and they're running right there. Then they found a little bit of the region.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then, so we found the region in this frame, then we found the region in the next frame. And we want to make sure that they all sort of, you know, you see how nicely aligned all these people are. They're sort of, you know, they put all the little bounding boxes together, but you see they kind of all line up all this way, and they all lined up that way. That means that they've stabilized them very well. And in order to help that, after they did this temporal differencing to sort of find where the moving person is, they did a kind of cross-correlation. They took the pixel values and they kind of shifted it this way and this way to get the best match. And then once they have the best match with
what
the...
What do you really get after you different the image? You wouldn't get the whole body of person. You just get...
Well, I don't know. It depends on how much their body matches the background, how quickly it's moving to mean how blurred it is or something like
that. Are they working in grayscale image?
I don't know. They have color data, so they might have done the temporal difference on the gray, or they might have done it on the color. Right. But anyway, that gives you a rough idea where the person is, but you'll have missed maybe some pixels. And then I think what they probably did is they went back to, the original color data, and then they took the picture from one frame and the picture from the next frame, and then they okay, so they tried sort of doing a cross-correlation here, and then they picked the position which had the highest cross-correlation and said, okay, that's my stabilized.